threat of violence from unknown protesters out in the woods or in the crowds or whatever, and they'll think of anything they can to distract the jury from the issue. But that, what we're asking the jury is actually a simple question. Look at the videotape. Do you think that this kind of painful chemical weapon should be constitutionally allowed as coercion and as punishment on peaceful protesters? And so we keep coming back to that and honing in on that. And it's a hard task sometimes because the system is slanted against us in many ways. We saw in jury selection, people are coming from upbringings in this country where we're taught to bow to law enforcement, where respect for authority and private property are paramount. But we're bringing the forest into the courtroom with us. We're trying to speak truth to power. We're remembering the quote from abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who said, "Power concedes nothing without a demand." We've got to be that demand, and the limits on us are quite strong sometimes. We're not allowed to talk about the strong appellate win that we've already had in this case from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is actually at the higher level than the federal court that we're having the jury trial in now. And they said that they felt it was excessive force, and we definitely deserved another jury trial. And, I mean, they were very adamant about it, and for various reasons, of which feel to be biased, we're not allowed to talk to the jury about that appellate win. We feel it should influence the law that they consider when they decide this case. We're also not able to go into depth about the intense outrage that came out once the issue hit the media. We are able to talk about the forest issues a little bit, and the plaintiffs are doing a good job of explaining the crisis that was at hand. I mean, radical history shows us that there's these times in history when there's something that needs to be done, and it's not just going to be done through appropriate authoritarian loving channels. So people sit in, they stand up, they march, they take over, they occupy space, and they create a creative tension, as Martin Luther King said, and we're trying to preserve the ability to do that, and situations aren't really getting better for civil rights in this country. They're getting worse. So we see our case as a little window to shed light on the abuses that happen every day to all kinds of people, working people, poor people, people of color, and do not make the evening news.
Right. And as a matter of fact, in listening to some of the testimony the other day, I was struck by the idea that each of the eight plaintiffs have different reasons why they showed up. In some cases, it's specifically to protect the Redwoods, but the Charles Hurwitz is one of the famous of the three savings and loans crooks. There was Ivan Boesky, there was Michael Milken, and there was Charles Hurwitz. He took over a multitude of corporations, and he stole the pension funds. He created the ability, the precedent, so to speak, of stealing from pension funds to take over other corporations, and then essentially looting whole regions of the country and outsourcing jobs. He essentially created the opportunity to sell redwood trees to selling them overseas, which was actually prevented in some of the California law, that you couldn't sell certain natural resources overseas because they were seen as finite. And he created the opportunity to cut down redwoods and create such a glut on the market that instead of making products that would last, he started creating cheap lawn furniture that would break this first time a fat man would sit on it. And taking 800-year-old redwoods and breaking it in the first use. So Charles Hurwitz is just one of many reasons why this case and the protests went forward. By the way, that expert you were talking about was coming up for their side, I'd like to get into that just a hair. They're creating, and they did create, cruel and usual punishment. They've ramped up this ability to make usual torture and to make usual the use of pepper spray. You mentioned that he's now also working for the Taser Company. I have a CD-ROM that came from the Taser Company, and in it mentioned that the 50,000 volts from a Taser The oldest versions of Taser expected that 90 to 95% of the electric volts would go into your clothing, and that only about 5 to 10% of the electric shock would hit you. So, of 50,000 watts or 50,000 volts, I believe it is, you would get 5 to 10,000 volts. But now the new version redirects the voltage, so it's still 50,000, but it's now it aims the electricity through your clothing, and that only 5 to 10% get buffered by your clothes, and you get a 40 to 45,000 watt volt or shot. So that might explain why there are many more deaths that are showing up with the use of tasers. Tell us about this expert that they had, and was there some testimony that went toward your side?
Yes, there was, actually. He did admit that there were over 100 deaths associated with pepper spray. And then when he was questioned by his lawyers on the law enforcement side, they tried to clarify that the coroners found the pepper spray to not be the cause in every instance. And the reason for that is because coroners, as county officials, are not, there's not been enough pressure or education or whatever the reason. I mean, I'm sure it's industry insidiousness, but the coroners are not listing pepper spray as the cause of death. They're listing heart attack or heart failure or things of this nature, you know, lungs collapsed or stopped breathing, and really the causation is the pepper spray, and then perhaps being hogtied with hands behind the back and left in a police van. The pattern continues. People are dying in police custody, and especially people of color and poor people who are always targeted more often by the police. There's a class thing and the race thing going on, and this testimony from the Taser company employee was quite scary because I mean he's basically saying he wasn't willing to say death or that someone died in custody. He would say subjects were known to expire, and every word was watered down or technical legalese, and they were really trying to pull one over on the jury. But I don't think it's going to fly. I think everyday people can see when someone's trying to skew things like that. So he also said in the pepper spray incidents in our case, or rather, should I say, assaults, because they weren't neutral incidents, but the pepper spray assaults, he said that the female subjects seemed to handle the pain quite well. And really, his testimony was quite scary, a testament to where we might be heading if we condone this kind of behavior.
Right. Well, straight to Abu Ghraib. This is a cruel, unusual punishment. We've seen the development of the shoes and the what's going on in Pelican Bay and the extreme torture that's been going on in the prison industrial complex for the last number of decades. The ramping up of usual, cruel and unusual becomes usual, and then the standards become okay for future to be ramped up again.
I won't say that what happened to us is anything like Abu Ghraib, but I will say that the line needs to be drawn to all kinds of abuses like this, and we see with the never-ending war in Iraq the incredible atrocities that happened with that, and I think that there's a desensitization, and there's a favorite expression I've read in author Derek Jensen's writing, and he was quoting another incredible writer that says, war abroad goes hand in hand with repression at home. And that being an aspect of civilization, almost this resource-driven war elsewhere, and then internal domestic repression at home. So keeping all of us who live here in the belly of the beast sedated or repressed or jailed or pepper sprayed or tasered or whatever they try to come at us with, and then engaging in genocidal foreign policies, quote-unquote, elsewhere in the world, and we wonder why they hate us. So we're doing this case trying to keep the larger context in mind and hoping everybody will come on down, and I do want to give a shout-out to where the trial is and ask people to come on down. It's at the San Francisco Federal Building Courthouse. It's right near Civic Center BART. The address is 450 Golden Gate Avenue, and it's in Judge Susan Ilston's courtroom, and that's room number 10, way up on the 19th floor, and you have to bring a photo ID to get in, and the court schedule is Monday through Thursday, 8:30 in the morning to 1:30 in the afternoon. And if you weren't able to write all that down, I don't blame you, but we have a website with a ton of information, and that is nopepperspray.org. And I really thank you all for listening. Thanks, David, for having me on the show, and we'll be back with some more reports. I go on the stand tomorrow, so we'll keep the listeners updated. And just remember, power concedes nothing without a demand.
Well, that's right. And, yeah, thank you again, Spring. We'll look forward to getting, with any luck, we'll get you tomorrow as well, doing a wrap-up for the week. And then I think you mentioned off-air that you're expecting that the plaintiffs will conclude tomorrow, and then the defense will have their witnesses, and this will probably go to the jury sometime next week.
That's right, mid next week. So let's cross our fingers and hope that we'll have a unanimous jury verdict against police excessive force by the end of next week.
All right. Thank you again, Spring.
All right. Rock on, everybody.
All right. Night. All right. So that again was Spring Lundberg, one of the eight plaintiffs in the infamous pepper spray case that's going on in the federal district courts right now. You're listening to Enemy Combatant Radio here in San Francisco, and we'll continue with the interviews.